Happy morning after Election Day, Kansas City. There's a new mayor set to take over the job on August 1st, Quentin Lucas. And to start today's show, I want to spend a few minutes talking with John Elligo of the New York Times. He's based here in Kansas City, and he co-wrote an article that ran in the Times this past Sunday on the Kansas City mayoral race. The premise was that this mayoral race is representative of something cities are wrestling with nationwide: the tension between now thriving downtowns and the neighborhoods that are still struggling just a stone's throw away. I'm Gina Kaufman. John Elligo, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Do you see the outcome of this election reflecting where the city stands on what matters now?
Well, I think definitely, as we wrote in that article, there has been this tension, between when you see downtown thriving, and lots of people like it. And lots of people use downtown. Lots of people like to go down there for shows, for concerts, for the restaurants and whatnot. But then, you look in the shadow of that, there's these neighborhoods where there are still a lot of struggles, where there are, a lot of vacant homes, lots that are, abandoned with, illegal dumping and stuff going on. So I think that was a theme for both Quentin and Jolie. But I think in some ways, Quentin, that was kind of like where he made his mark, because he comes from the east side where you have most of these problems. So that was really the mark that Quentin made. So now the question will be whether he can actually deliver on those, on some of those promises.
In recent years, the way that the conversation around this unfolds has changed. But it used to be that people would talk about revitalizing the urban core. And I'm putting that in quote marks. What they often meant was revitalizing the core of downtown. And I've heard many times advocates for racial justice, for neighborhood equality, et cetera, coming on this show and saying the urban core is not downtown.
Exactly. I remember when I sat with Quentin to talk to him for the article, he said, even when we talk about neighborhoods, because the buzzword was neighborhoods, we're going to come out to the neighborhoods.
We're not talking about all neighborhoods.
Exactly. He said exactly that. Like, it depends on what neighborhoods we're talking about, right? And it was interesting. It was interesting to me to see how that played out because, Jolie talked about walking the length of the city, going to different neighborhoods. And while she did talk, very much about, some of the east side neighborhoods that are more economically distressed, she did have maybe more of a message of like, hey, I'm going to help all neighborhoods, because, when I talk to people in Ruskin Heights, I hear the same things that I hear in, Ivanhoe and in other types of neighborhoods. Quentin was maybe, he made a more direct appeal to saying, hey, I'm looking at the east side and, that's where I'm from. And these places have been more historically disinvested. So he made a real aggressive play towards saying, hey, we are looking at these particular neighborhoods that have seen underinvestment and that happen to be predominantly Black.
Interestingly, if you look at question one, you might come away with a slightly different interpretation of how far this goes, of how far people, if you look at it as downtown versus adjacent neighborhoods and where the investment is going, the sense of how extreme people are landing on firmly on one side or the other might not, it might not seem be as extreme as all that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the thing with question one, even the mayoral candidates, even Quentin and Jolie, I think they both opposed it. And I think the question is, it's how those incentives are used, right? People may not necessarily be against incentives as a whole, but it's how they're used. I think there's this feeling, the sentiment when I talk to voters, there's a sentiment that, we're basically incentivizing and giving more money to very wealthy developers to continue to build on that wealth in certain parts of town. Now, if those developers want to step out and maybe help, uplift other parts of the community, I think folks may not be so against it. So I think, when you have something like question one, that's why folks, they still want to preserve the chance of having incentives, but if they want to say, hey, how can we start redirecting them, start incentivizing them to use incentives in other parts of town?
Do you see this as a statement of maybe where we are with downtown development as a city? Because I feel like part of the argument here isn't that it's not that downtown doesn't matter. It's that downtown is now doing fine. Let's shift our focus. Is that how you would interpret this?
Yeah, well, the question is really if downtown, if it still needs a lot of that support and that uplift. And I think if you talk to certain business people, certain developers, you will hear that, hey, yeah, it still does need some. And I think it is complicated, right? It's not just okay, now downtown's fine, you can forget about it, abandon it. But it's like, is it self-sustaining on its own, So I think Quentin's message has been one very much of like saying, hey, we've done enough. We haven't focused enough on the neighborhoods. And again, when I talked to him, I remember one of his messages was very clear that, hey, it's out of balance, it's out of whack. So in some ways you'd have to say that this election is sort of a mandate or some sort of a message that, hey, you know, let's shift that balance a little bit.
Part of that shifting of balance is not just talking about where money is invested geographically, but where it's invested sort of in like the spectrum of problems the city needs to tackle. Yep. And it's sort of like moving up on that list of combating crime. It seems like it has risen in the priorities in this campaign season. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard addressing violent crime take on the level of significance in previous campaigns that it has this time.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be one of the tricky things. Is, you know, Quentin, he did get support from the police, but you know, in sort of that kind of progressive mold and that he sometimes talks in, decreasing crime is not necessarily synonymous with, you know, increasing police presence and stuff like that, even though that is one of the things that I think he's talked about doing, and that is one of the things that people want. They want more police on the streets. But it's how do you balance, you know, the law enforcement aspect of it, meaning like giving police department resources and getting, you know, more police on the street. Well, we noting that, you know, Kansas City does not control its own police departments, that done by the state board, but also looking at some of the more core factors that lead to crime, whether it be that joblessness, whether it be housing instability, those types of factors that lead to some of these crimes that we talk about. And the challenge with that has always been, I think if you look across the country, people want to talk about that, but when it comes to mayoral races, when it comes to people on their everyday lives, like making schools better, you know, creating more jobs is a great thing, but you don't always see the return on reducing crime right away. That's a long-term plan. So it's like, how does Quentin then go about, you know, investing in those things and getting people to stay the course and say, hey, this will eventually lead to results, you know, but, you know, maybe in the short term, you might not see it as much. And that's always a tricky thing, because as a politician, right, you have to kind of please now. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because on the one hand, you do have, like I said, the law enforcement aspect. On the other hand, you have the investment and the societal aspect of it.
Race is your beat. And I think there maybe is kind of a racial undertone to some of the conversations around all of this, but it is not always stated explicitly, like what the relationship is between these conversations about neighborhoods and downtown and race. Can we go there for just a minute? How would you spell that out if you were to spell it out right now?
Well, it's clear that the reason that this divide has developed, because back in, you know, not to go too far in history, but, you know, back in the mid-20th century, there was this white flight from the cities, you know, with a lot of the wealth and whatnot going to the suburbs. And that basically what you were left to these cities with predominantly black people and Hispanic people left in there. You know, lack of investment, they deteriorate, they crumble. And then, you know, over the past couple, you know, 20 years or so, we've had this inversion happening where a lot of white folks who were living in the suburbs and whatnot are now returning to the cities. And I think
that often gets stated as people are coming back to the city.
Exactly. People are coming back when there's already always been people here who have never left, you know. And I think, you know, where it comes in, you start to see a lot of resentment building, and probably rightfully so, is that suddenly there's all this investment coming where white folks are settling, whereas there's people who've been here, who've stuck it out, who haven't been able to leave, haven't wanted to leave, and their neighbors still aren't seeing that investment. So, let's be clear, you know, like, I think if you talk to the downtown council and things like that, some of their data suggests that downtown is pretty diverse, but, you know, they might be taking a broader view of the boundaries of downtown than most people. But
counting some of those neighborhoods
exactly,
that feel they've not been invested
exactly,
in.
Exactly, exactly. But if you really look at the core, like some of those luxury apartments and things that are coming up like that, it's predominantly white. I mean, there's no way around it. It's more white than the city is white. And I think that's where you get a lot of this questions of like how race plays into it. Like, why is it that when a lot of white people move back into cities, move back into certain areas, those places suddenly get a lot of investment and a lot of infusion of money, where, you know, there's been decades where folks have been living in the city where there hasn't been any infusion of investment. And now I know we do have to note there are certain economic factors at play, but throughout this country, you know, through whether it be through housing or whatnot, you definitely see values being tied strictly to race, you know, in terms of like housing, how much housing is valued, how much real estate is valued. There are racial components to that, and that's something that we can't deny.
I was interested in this article that you wrote in Sunday's Times about how this is representative of something happening all over the country. Of course, many of these issues are nationwide, but how it plays out, particularly in Kansas City, feels so Kansas City to me. What do you think this is emblematic of nationally?
I think it's emblematic of a couple things. One, I think it's emblematic of this development that we've seen in downtowns and how a lot of cities have gone aggressively and how people are now looking around and saying, okay, this has all happened, but yet in my neighborhood, you know, the water's not working properly and whatnot. Like, where is all this investment coming to my neighbor? So I think you're really seeing folks talking about those income and those wealth disparities and really seeing it play out in their lives.
John Elligo of the New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next, if loneliness is killing you, ironically, you're not alone. We'll talk about collective loneliness and how it's affecting us when we return.
In a country of more than 60 million people, and in an age where we can instantly connect with friends, relatives, and even strangers around the world, it may seem counterintuitive that any of us could find ourselves feeling lonely.
That's Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Britain, in 2018. In this speech, she's kicking off a national campaign to address loneliness, and she means business. Her announcement includes the unveiling of a new government position, someone called the Minister for Loneliness. This person was going to take charge of combating loneliness throughout the UK. The reaction, stateside, reveals how not seriously we take loneliness here in the U.S. Listen to Stephen Colbert.
How is it supposed to work? The ministry has reviewed your application, and you are not lonely enough, I'm afraid. Your application for affection has been denied.
But scientific research in the last decade shows our brains may be hardwired for social connection. And not just that, without those connections, our health can suffer. So while the British are taking on loneliness and social isolation as a very real public health issue, are we doing anything about it here? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we're comparing Britain's approach to loneliness with our own, starting with KCUR health reporter Alex Smith. He got a big journalism fellowship to travel to the UK and see what the difference really looks like. And the stories that came out of that are playing on Morning Edition all week this week. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Gina.
What gave you the idea to look into loneliness as something that can and maybe should be addressed not just by pop songs, but by national policy?
Mm-hmm. So last year, I did a lot of reporting on opioids and rural health problems, and after talking with a lot of people and visiting a lot of these communities, I couldn't help thinking about, you know, what all these places and people had in common. And it turns out health researchers have been thinking about the same thing, and they suspect that a root problem may be social isolation or loneliness, which, as you said, in the past few years, scientists have been finding out can really have a lot of serious effects on our mental and physical health.
This is in stark comparison to the U.S. and specifically the Midwest, where there is some acknowledgement that a dip in life expectancy for white men could be related to a lack of social support and emotional well-being.
That's right. I mean, a lot of rural communities especially have been struggling with health problems for a while, like obesity, heart disease, you know, drug overdoses, and diseases that are usually considered preventable. But in the past few years, it's really reached a critical point where, I mean, life expectancy in a lot of these places has essentially been going backwards. I mean, people are dying younger because of overdoses or suicide or preventable disease. And some researchers have called this deaths of despair, although I should say not everybody's crazy about that term because they think it might be sort of an oversimplification of a pretty complex phenomenon.
What does the science say, though, about the relationship between loneliness and health? Can you spell that out a little more?
Well, yeah, the research is still in early stages, but scientists think that when a lot of people feel alone or lonely, their stress systems kind of kick into high gear. They get flooded with stress hormones, and that's fine for a while, but if it continues over a long period of time, it can lead to heart issues, mental health problems, sleep disorder. It could even affect our immune system.
But this isn't just about old people living off in remote rural areas increasingly left behind, and that's kind of a narrative we hear a lot. It is about young people living everywhere in cities, you know.
Right. I mean, at first, this was basically just a theory. And, you know, everybody assumed that the people who would be the loneliest would be in rural areas. But then scientists actually started talking to people and asking about this. And they found out that younger people, and in a lot of cases, younger people in younger cities, report the most loneliness of any group.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, that's something that we're still kind of trying to piece apart. But I mean, I think it does have something to do with social media, something to do with people just feeling disconnected. I mean, there could be some economic issues involved.
You started by going to England for 3 weeks. I remember it well because we are married to each other. And speaking of loneliness, that was kind of lonely for me. But OK, remind me, where did you go? What did you see?
So, yeah, that was, I spent about a week in London where a lot of the research and government work are sort of being done, the high-up level work. But then I spent most of the time in other cities and smaller towns where these projects and programs are actually taking place. I went to Manchester, which is a really young city, and there's a big focus right now on helping younger people feel less lonely. I went to a small town in Western England called Frome, which we'll hear more about tomorrow, and is considered one of the big success stories of fighting loneliness. And then, of course, Liverpool, which we've been hearing about today.
One of the stories that caught my attention was about something called the Men's Shed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. The Men's Shed movement is a project or, you know, kind of a whole program that's really taken off in the UK, and we'll hear about that on Friday. But basically, these are community-run workshops that are mostly for older men to give them a place to work on projects together and basically just hang out.
In the piece, one of the guys who's been involved with a Men's Shed says that women connect well face-to-face, but men do better shoulder-to-shoulder. What does that mean?
Well, so not everyone becomes sociable just because they're in a room together with other people. And one of the hardest to reach groups for loneliness is older men. So loneliness experts say that for these people, they don't really do great face to face. And instead,
so not like a coffee date. That's not a great
plan. Right, exactly. And so instead, they really relate to each other better by working together on projects. I mean, just in a lot of cases, literally standing shoulder to shoulder.
And people have been studying the outcomes of this and trying to replicate it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Men's Shed, again, is considered one of the big sort of success stories of this. I mean, people who take part in sheds, they report greater levels of happiness, improvements in health. And I should say this hasn't been rigorously studied by health researchers, but this has been a big runaway success. And so they've been looking at, you know, what it is about, you know, men working together or working together sort of with a sense of purpose that really, you know, why that is such an effective means of kind of combating loneliness.
The Shed interested me a lot. So did the bar that had become kind of a community center. Where was that again?
That was in Liverpool. And just a little bit of background there. In the last 10 years, the UK has had these austerity cuts that have led to the closing a lot of community centers, senior centers, etc. And so these cuts have really hit Liverpool, the hardest of any city. I mean, people say that it's really had some pretty significant impacts there. So a senior care worker I met named Sue Benson-Carson basically started her own community center as a way for people who she'd taken care of before, just as a place to give them to go, to hang out, to kind of socialize, really a community hub.
And doctors are a part of this too. I mean, in Frome, I believe it was, there's just one medical center, and so everyone goes there, and the doctor who runs it has embraced something called social prescribing.
Yeah, I mean, Frome is way ahead of the curve on this. About 6 or 7 years ago, they started this program where the health clinics prescribes patients to try community activities. And the town itself has really gotten behind this. They've created tons of clubs and organizations for people to try. I met a lot of people in Frome who say they go to several different clubs or music groups or whatever every week.
As prescribed by their doctors.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this is something the whole town is really proud of.
You came home and looked into what we are and aren't addressing here relating to loneliness. What were your big takeaways on that, especially with this frame of reference for how it looks different somewhere else?
Well, yeah, in the UK, there's this national campaign that we're talking about. In the US, there is just honestly really nothing even close. I mean, we do have some private Medicare programs that are kind of experimenting with loneliness programs. But for the most part, I mean, this work is all just being done. I mean, what work that is being done in this in the US has just been done by community programs. I mean, there's really very little that's happening kind of on the health side.
One of the interesting things to me in today's story was that the whole thing in England seems to come out of a recognition that there austerity had maybe gone too far and had maybe had the unintended consequence of removing that social safety net. I think one of your sources talked about the many caring for the few, that had kind of deteriorated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the UK, I mean, this idea of like collective responsibility is really deeply ingrained. I mean, it comes out of the two world wars, which really left the country in pretty rough shape, and the creation of a national healthcare system that takes care of everyone. And there is a lot of concern right now in the UK that after all these austerity cuts, that the national government is really kind of giving up on this and really leaving communities just to sort of fend for themselves.
And so Theresa May was like, no, we're going to fix this. We're going to have a minister for loneliness.
Well, yeah. I mean, she's also coming from, you know, some austerity supporters. I mean, she herself is an austerity supporter, and, you know, her party is at least. And so there's a little bit of a conflict there, and some people pointing out some maybe hypocrisy of just, you know, are we addressing loneliness at the same time that we might be sort of contributing to it?
Well, the piece on austerity in this project, the project sort of ominously titled Loneliness is Killing You, that aired this morning. I want to play the first few minutes in case some of our listeners didn't catch it. This is Alex Smith reporting from England.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed.
Along the Mersey River on England's northwest coast, the tourist traps of Liverpool make it almost impossible to forget about the city's most famous export. Sheila Maitland was growing up here when the Beatles were still just a local band, and many Liverpool natives say their working-class neighborhoods felt like big families.
If you needed a slice of bread, we'd give you a slice of bread. If you needed a cup of milk, you'd knock next door, go over the road. Everyone in your street was your auntie. Go over to Auntie Mary. We never had much, but we never went short.
Hey. Alex?
Yeah?
Nice to meet you, okay?
Hey.
A cup of tea? Sure.
Sounds great.
This is Karen. Hi, Alex.
Hey. Senior care worker Sue Benson Carson runs the Bridge Community Center in an old Liverpool neighborhood where the city's famous hospitality, humor, and accent are on full display. Within minutes of stepping through the door, guests are welcomed with a cup of tea and an introduction to each and every one of the center's regulars.
Do you hear what he says? You talk like Donny Osmond. Have you met Donny Osmond?
Liverpool is a blue-collar town that's spent decades trying to keep up, while bigger, wealthier cities, particularly London, have become even richer thanks to industries like finance. But many Liverpool natives say their situation has gotten worse the Great Recession. In the aftermath of that crisis, the government embarked on a long-term program of spending cuts to reduce the deficit. These included cuts to welfare, police, and local governments. Benson Carson started the volunteer-run Bridge Center in an old Salvation Army building in response to those cuts. She says many of her neighbors had nowhere else to turn after losing services they had depended on for years.
Them services that were set up have actually failed people, and they're still failing people by closing the doors. So they set all these services up for people with mental health disabilities, able-bodied people, elderly people, and yet they pulled all the funds in. So it's just like, I just don't get it. I don't understand it.
When austerity cuts were introduced in 2010, the UK had a deficit of £144 billion. Mims Davis is a Conservative Member of Parliament, and she's the current Minister for Sport, Civil Society, and Loneliness. Like many austerity supporters, she says the cuts were difficult but necessary to get the country living within its means.
So none of these were easy, and many communities have, you know, had to take tough decisions. I've been a local councillor. I was in that myself, so I understand that.
Yet austerity supporters say the cuts have gone far beyond fiscal responsibility.
No ifs, no buts, no public sector cuts. No ifs, no buts, no public sector cuts.
Austerity protests have brought hundreds of thousands of people to march in the streets in recent years. They accuse austerity supporters of using budget worries as an excuse to tear apart a welfare system that's been in place for generations. Maggie O'Carroll heads the Women's Organization, a Liverpool nonprofit.
We had, you know, universal services. We had a safety net that if things went wrong in your world, you became ill, you became disabled or whatever, that, you know, the whole would look after the few.
Today, critics say that austerity has stripped neighborhoods of community cornerstones like senior centers, libraries, and safe public spaces, leaving people more isolated. They blame austerity for the steady uptick in poverty over the past 5 years. Liverpool has seen the biggest local government cuts per person of any city in the UK, according to the Centre for Cities, which reports that since austerity began, Liverpool's local government budget has been reduced by nearly a third, the equivalent of more than $1,000 per resident. The effects haven't just been economic, according to Dr. Martin McKee, a professor of public health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
We've really seen major deterioration in mental health, both in terms of how people describe their health, but also in the extreme manifestation of poor mental health, which is suicide. There have been an increase in suicides, particularly in those areas that have been most badly affected.
Research also shows an increase in deaths among older people, especially those who've seen services cut. The National Health Service was technically spared from austerity cuts, but critics say the small funding increases it's received have not been enough to keep up with the population's needs. But McKee thinks that's only part of the problem. Like many researchers who've studied health declines in places like the Ozarks, he blames many of the problems on hopelessness and loneliness among people staring down both poverty and an unraveling safety net.
So increasingly what we're seeing is people who are living much more precarious existence on the edge, where they may not know where their income is coming from week to week, for example.
So now we're back in the studio here at KCUR. And Alex, you know, you referenced the Ozarks there. Do you suppose we could be on the cusp of a similar realization here? Because the description of cuts to funding for social services and things like mental health, et cetera, do not sound all that different from what we've been coping with in the Midwest.
Well, yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of parallels, and it's not just me saying that. There was a big study done last year by the Missouri Health Foundation, and I think I'm saying that name wrong, but anyway, a big study done by researchers at Virginia Commonwealth University about Missouri and about a lot of these health declines, and they pointed to the same thing, that a lot of this is sort of a combination of people feeling alienated and also losing a lot of, you know, services and, you know, economies declining. So there's definitely some parallels.
Call 816-235-2888 to talk about how loneliness has affected your life. Do you find it hard to connect in the modern world? And if so, have you found ways around that? What's helped you find community? 816-235-2888. My next guests can talk a little more specifically to Kansas City. Daniel Serta is an urban design expert, and Katie Stover works at the Kansas City Public Library. Hi, you two.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Daniel, how does the way Kansas City is built, to your mind, either bring us together or keep us apart? What role does design play in it, any of this?
Well, the physical environment around us is one of the most critical influences on our ability to socialize and interact with other people. There are economic and there are social influences as well. But if you don't have sort of intermediate spaces, and it doesn't always necessarily have to be a formally designed public space like a garden or a square, but if you don't have the opportunity, for example, to walk down a street, if you don't have the opportunity to linger when you're doing something else, to have informal interactions with strangers on a routine basis, that can absolutely contribute to social isolation.
So how does Kansas City do on this, providing those kinds of spaces?
We're doing much better. I think
better
than we had been, because first there's been a general resurgence. You know, we've got urban redevelopment, we've got downtown alive again, we've got a lot of development happening now at a scale that is better suited for informal socializing, which is really critical to people's not only sense of how interesting a city is, but really to a very personal sense of fulfillment and interaction with people you don't necessarily know very well.
You know, we were talking in the previous segment about downtown thriving, but maybe communities in the immediate surrounding area still struggling.
Sure.
Are those opportunities for interaction equally distributed, or do you see a similar sort of disproportion?
No, they're not. And they're impacted differentially by people's economic and social well-being otherwise. So give an example, you know, if you have a disinvested urban neighborhood where you don't have good sidewalks, where you don't have a neighborhood park that's perceived as or actually as safe as a place to gather, people are going to tend to stay at home quite a bit. And that's going to inhibit their informal socializing that happens both with their neighbors and with other people.
So to piggyback on that example, how does a park in a neighborhood, is there a governmental role, a community role, a planning role in making that park be perceived as safe?
There's a combination of all of the above. You know, it starts first and foremost with the actual infrastructure investments, replacing equipment, maintaining the grounds, basic maintenance that has to be undertaken typically by the city. But it also relies on, you know, neighborhood associations, networks, and other groups coming together to make improvements and advocate for improvements in that kind of a space, and also to help structure regular programming, regular activities that happen there. It can be as simple as having a walking club, for example, as a number of urban neighborhoods in Kansas City have done over the last several years, that meets maybe on Tuesday nights or on Saturday mornings and gives people an opportunity to come out, to join together, to feel safe, to be safe, and to really enjoy each other's company.
How does Kansas City compare with other cities where you've lived or that you've studied on this issue of a built environment that is either conducive or not to people getting together, in the city together?
Yeah. My perception is there's a growing awareness of how critically important this is, both to the health and the functioning of neighborhoods, as well as to individual health. We have a lot of neighborhoods that are distressed not only economically, but by various health indicators, and this is known. So if you have an effort like the example that I cited before, that brings people out, that draws people out, that gets them engaged in almost passive recreation, right? Maybe something as simple as walking, not necessarily aerobics or a lot of structured exercise per se, but the opportunity to get out, move around. There's also a social dimension to that that's critically important. And one of the things that we know from a variety of both public health and built environment research is that opportunities for socialization and interaction at that level are critically important to emotional health, which in turn, as Alex alluded to, is directly correlated with physical health and a lot of physical health indicators.
Daniel, is there, if you could just point to one thing that Kansas City is not doing along these lines right now, but could or should be, that would really improve this whole like creation of spaces where people can convene and naturally convene, what would it be?
I think it really has to do less with what we're doing. I think we're doing some of what we need to be doing. We're not doing enough of it. And that involves dedication to public resources, that involves dedication to philanthropic resources that would support community level efforts to put together these kinds of initiatives that are both physical improvements and the programming and the activities that I was alluding to, and scaling them for different sizes and characters of neighborhoods. Sometimes there's a tendency to think, well, we fixed that park over there and everybody can go there. And we don't recognize that that park over there is not within a 15-minute walking radius for everybody. It's not within a 15-minute safe drive for everybody. Not everybody has access to transportation over there. I hate to say this because it sounds a little bit daunting, but it is. Every neighborhood needs that kind of physical fabric where people feel safe, they feel welcome, they feel like they can go out and engage with people in a very congenial kind of environment.
Where everybody's their auntie?
Well, you know, euphemistically speaking, yeah. I mean, there's references to this in the urban design literature, the idea of sort of the mayors and the block captains, the watchful eyes, the known actors, even on a city block level, that really take a certain pride of stewardship and of guiding and being sort of the reference points and the trusted authority within neighborhoods. It's really a critical part of, again, how people relate to and interact with their neighbors and with people that they don't necessarily know very well.
I want to turn to Katie Stover. Katie, is the library a place that you think fills the role of addressing loneliness, helping people combat what an expert in Alex's series has called collective loneliness?
It's certainly a place folks can gather, since austerity in England has cut down on social community centers and libraries. So the American libraries are definitely a place for people to come and maybe assuage some of their loneliness in a very low-impact way. So if you're not quite certain how to interact with strangers and you just need to go be in this world and not of it, libraries are a great place for that. So you can walk into a library and there's lots of activity and you can be a part of it or you can just observe it and still feel not as lonely because you're around others.
And it doesn't maybe take the kind of proactive gumption of joining a club.
Yes. So you can walk into a library and you are as recognized or as invisible as you choose to be. The staff is there to help you as needed. We'll make eye contact, we'll smile, we will recognize that you exist. And then if you want to dart into the stacks and just wander around the books and feel comfortable knowing that there are others around, that can be enough for some people. If you want to sit in one of our grand reading rooms and read the newspaper or magazine, anything you brought with you, or even just sit and look around and be part of the community that way, that's very helpful for some folks, especially folks who might feel some social anxiety that spending too much time alone can enhance. So libraries are
very good places to maybe start get over any anxiety or loneliness you have. And then, because the programs are open and you are not expected to perform or do anything more than just show up and sit in one of our seats, you can participate that way as much as you like. You can attend one of the events. You can attend a book group. You can attend any movie and just be there and then talk to your neighbors if you wish.
Katie, do library people talk about this really consciously, like that in your library training and in library conferences, is being the place that does those things part of what you see as like your mission, your role in a community?
We do see that as our role in the community. And you asked, do we talk about it? I'll be going to a conference later this week and I will bring that up. In general, no, we don't, because for all the librarians I know and all the people I know who work in libraries, this is just unstated. This is something that we know that we do. This is a purpose that we serve.
I was recently at a public radio conference where we were all sharing with each other from stations nationwide that there's an increased demand for live events where people can gather in a physical space together. Events like identical to ones people were trying to get some off the ground a decade ago, struggling to get even a smattering of attendees, are now selling out. And not just selling out every now and then, consistently events selling out and people asking for more and more and more. Are you seeing a similar phenomenon at the library?
Oh, we are constantly asked for events. And since you bring that up, a good example is book groups. I am getting asked more and more from people in the community who want to start a book group or they are looking for one. Because library-sponsored book groups, no one's grading you if you read the book. At my book group today, everyone is welcome. Some people will have read the book, some people will have not, but they're there for the social. They're there for the social elements. They're also there to talk actively about what we read. But everyone is welcome in a library program. So if you need to just test it and see how it fits with your personality or your social comfort level, you can do that. And no one's going to hold you accountable for anything more than just showing up.
Is there something in this that you think maybe other sectors could learn from? Because it strikes me as really interesting that there isn't the conscientious effort and yet the effort seems to be successful to the point that people know that they can come to you and ask for what they need.
I think they know they can come to the library and ask for what they need because the library is free and open to the public. We are a free-for-all. We know it. We want to be. I would say that libraries also, we're just as strapped as other agencies might be. We have space to consider, we have the hours that we're open to consider, we have staff to consider. So we do our best to accommodate every request we get, but we, like other institutions, have limited resources.
Daniel, is there something that you're hearing in this that could be translated to like a citywide philosophy or approach?
Well, I think if you think about that conceptually, the library is playing a certain institutional role. And the library could look at itself in a very narrow sense, right? We're here to provide books. We lend books. All of that other stuff is just sort of extra. And it might not be a priority. It has become a priority. And I think that's where you see the real embrace of a public institution like a library. There are other like entities, whether it's community centers, informal, what we often refer to as third places, which can be commercial businesses. It could be a barbershop. It could be a coffee shop. It could be
third
something
places supposed, being basically not home and not work.
Not home and not work, places that people deliberately gather to socialize on a regular basis. So, you know, the tavern, the pub, the coffee shop, those kinds of places. And again, the barbershop. I mean, those are all places that people, it's not simply a matter of going there to buy a cup of coffee, right?
But
it's
can
a matter
you make the city a barbershop sort of? Or is that not possible?
It's the layering. It's the layering of a lot of initiative and a lot of effort. It's not simply that, you know, someone in City Hall can sort of, you know, stir the elixir and all of a sudden they magically stir people to come to something. But it's understanding, A, it takes the investment of time and resources, both, as you said, staffing as well as dollars. It takes a lot of effort. It takes making it a priority, whether it's implicit or explicit. But it's a matter of framing those opportunities for people to come together, again, whether it's formal or informal. And I like the notion, especially what you're talking about there, of, you know, you're not accountable for anybody other than showing up.
Alex, what are your thoughts as you listen to Katie and Daniel? Are you finding yourself traveling in your mind back to England where they navigate this in such a different way, this whole community versus loneliness spectrum?
Well, actually, the conversation here made me think about another aspect of this. And I mean, in the UK, they're doing all of these big scale programs and everything and trying to organize this on the scale of, you know, towns or even the whole country. But actually, there's some research that is from the US that came out a few years back called that talks about this phenomenon of what they call weak ties. And that's just the value of very small interactions that we have. I mean, maybe with just a neighbor or a stranger or something like that. I mean, the kinds of things that take place in, you know, libraries.
Those interactions, just the random 5-second.
Right. Just, you know, a little quick little conversation or something like that. And the researchers have actually found that if we have, you know, just a handful of these, you know, small weak tie kind of interactions every day, I mean, there's a group right now in the UK that sort of encourages 5 each day, that it can improve our happiness. And really recently, there's a new study, I think, out of Japan that said if we have, you know, several of these interactions every day, it can actually reduce cognitive decline for older people.
I like that there's like a recommended daily allowance.
Right.
Oh, Alex Smith, Katie Stover, Daniel Serta, thank you all so much for talking about this.
Thank
it was
you
a delight.
And FYI, Katie Stover has put together a list of books and reference materials for dealing with loneliness. We'll link to that list when we post the audio from this conversation later today. That'll be at kcur.org/centralstandard. I'm Gina Kaufman. When we return, some veterans are finally getting long overdue medals of valor from World War I. I said long overdue. That story's next. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And tonight, some veterans will be honored with medals of valor at the World War I Museum. The thing is, this honor is being bestowed on them a little late. These are not veterans of a recent war, but of World War I, which ended in 1918. This event is the result of a lot of research and formal review. The research was conducted here in Kansas City at Park University, and the guy who led that effort is with us now. Timothy Westcott runs the Center for the Study of the Great War at Park University. He also co-chairs the Valor Medal Review Task Force. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
Kind of a mouthful there.
That's fine.
What is a Medal of Valor? What are like the criteria for earning this distinction?
Well, there are actually three medals that fall under categorization of valor. Silver Star, and then there's the Distinguished Service Cross for Army, and then the Navy Cross would be for the Marine Corps, the Navy, Coast Guard. And then at the top of that pyramid is the Medal of Honor. So there's only three that classify as valor.
What does valor mean in this context?
Well, in what our case is, there's an act of heroic valor on the battlefield. And in most of these cases, it's some sense of verifiable, usually by two or more persons that actually saw the act of valor by a service member. And in our case, you know, we're looking at 5 groups that had served in World War I, African Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, Jewish Americans, and then Native Americans.
Why is that? I mean, why is there a task force to review these groups? Is the idea that these groups' service was on some large scale, perhaps not appropriately recognized at the time, and the desire to maybe correct that?
Perfect. We are looking at those classifications. If we would happen to look at our history, there were 120 medals of honor within the war. Only 7 have been awarded to any of those individuals. For Jewish Americans, to African Americans, and those have been, in the last 20 years, the African Americans, and then 1 Hispanic American. No medals of honor for Asian Americans or Native Americans.
How does that process work? The idea of a living eyewitness is going to be hard to pull off. How do you do the research to sort of right this historic wrong.
You're right. There are, you know, no living persons that would have seen the act of valor. So there's federal legislation pending in both the House and the Senate in which will sort of waive the statute of limitations, because there are statutes of limitations for the Medal of Honor, because we're 101 years away. So what we have to do as historians is try to find the archival first person actual primary document of those two. And then we also then reach out to descendants, which have been wonderful stories.
How can you give an example of a story that you've heard? No names, of course, any of that, but just the story that really got your imagination involved and your empathy involved.
No, I'm fine to share with stories, because I think the story that I'm going to represent is has to tie into the university and some past lectures that we've had. The center is named after George S. Robb, who was a 1912 graduate of
the Center for the Study of the Great War at Park University.
Yes, from Park College of Park University in 1912. We have located in the National Archives an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. At the top of that paper is the actual nomination for Robb to receive the Medal of Honor, which he did do. And on the same piece of paper at the bottom is the recommendation for a Medal of Honor for a gentleman named William A. Butler from Maryland. Butler was African American, did not receive the Medal of Honor, received the Distinguished Service Cross, received the Croix de Guerre with Palm, but did not actually receive the Medal of Honor.
What was his story? What did he do that, to your mind, would have clearly merited that Medal of Honor?
Well, in Butler's case, it was phenomenal valor of leading some troops on a machine gun nest, quote unquote, in the Meuse-Argonne of late September 1918.
What does that mean? Leading them on a machine gun nest? Forgive me.
Well, no. The Germans had machine gun nests, or areas that, in which they were dug in, and they more than likely had more than one machine gun in within this geographical region pointed toward the American troops. So it's sort of like the old Gatling gun type of the West. You run into this barrage of not just one machine gun, but multiple machine guns to try to overtake the German advance or the German army.
Wow. That sounds intense. You are a veteran, is that right?
Yes, I am. United States Marine Corps.
What does it mean to you to be undertaking this task on behalf of other veterans who lived in a different time, fought in a different, totally different contexts? Does this feel like an act of like brotherhood to you?
It does. And there are three undergraduate students that have done the research this academic year, and two of those are veterans. So not only myself, but two of the three are veterans. And we do have that kinship, I think, maybe that tie to maybe righting a wrong, but also then reconnecting to those families that, because I've spoken to two daughters, actual daughters of World War One vets. And it's a
Tell
wonderful
me about those conversations.
You know, one is lives in Missouri. She's in her 90s. And then the other one lives on the East Coast, probably in her 70s. It's just been phenomenal. I mean, they have shed tears because somebody's going to go back to their grandfather or father's records. But they always make sure at the end of any conversation, they say, you know, we're so glad that you're honoring our father or grandfather. But you also are sort of helping the family. You're helping
like the
us.
Like the healing process.
That healing process. Because of race or religion.
To feel recognized.
Yes.
Do you think that is there a lesson to be learned from looking back at history this way that you think might be applicable to the present, to how we honor people and how our biases might enter into that?
Yeah, I think there is. And for example, you know, a number of our citizens were slave, former slaves. H.R. 40 is on the committee floor right now for a commission to look at reparations. So there is this tie, even today, this morning.
Well, our time is up, but Timothy Westcott, thank you so, so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Timothy teaches history at Park University. He's also co-chair of the Valor Medals Review Task Force. And you can attend an event tonight at the World War I Museum. It's called From Kansas City to Washington, D.C. World War I Valor Medals Review. It starts at 6:30 and it's free to attend. And that is a wrap for today's show. You can listen back to anything you might have missed or get links to share stuff with your friends at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And it's also where you'll find Katie Stover's list of books and reference materials to help listeners out there deal with loneliness if they are so inspired. Tomorrow, the movie Always Be My Maybe is and isn't a traditional rom-com. It tells an age-old love story with new roles for Asian Americans and Keanu Reeves. Join that discussion tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Anne Kniggendorf, Salisa Kalakal, Chris Young, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.